Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you politics at the boring bits Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. Now, a special episode of the podcast today after all that party conference nonsense. As you may have picked up recently, I've got a book coming out this week. It's called Planes, Trains and Toilet Doors, 50 Places That Changed British Politics. So we thought on the pod today, we'd just bring you a sort of documentary about some of the places that I've been.
But I need to tell you something.
Tom Hanks's alarm goes off at 5 a.m. Tom Hanks sits up in bed in blue pyjamas. Tom Hanks says, "I really want to stop, but I just got a taste for it." Tom Hanks checks the bags under his eyes in the bathroom mirror. Tom Hanks drinks water. Tom Hanks is walking down the street, pointing and waving and high-fiving and fist-bumping in brown leather gloves. Tom Hanks signs an autograph, is given a table tennis bat and hits a ping-pong ball out of shot. Tom Hanks poses for selfies, hails a taxi, makes calls and reads texts. Tom Hanks watches as a bright yellow car drives past in slow motion. Tom Hanks dances in the street. Now, imagine all of that, but instead of Tom Hanks, it's Nick Clegg. And instead of the streets of Manhattan, it's the streets of Gravesend on an overcast day in March 2015. The Lib Dems were facing electoral wipeout after 5 years in coalition with the Conservatives, having tried everything to turn the party's fortunes around. A plan was hatched for Nick Clegg to star in a shot-for-shot recreation of the video for I Really Like You by the Canadian singer Carly Rae Jepsen, which originally starred Tom Hanks walking the streets and lip-syncing. Which is why Windmill Street, Gravesend is included in my new book, Planes, Trains and Toilet Doors, 50 Places That Changed British Politics. Although, strictly speaking, the Lib Dems never released the video. Maybe they should have done. They went on to slump from 57 MPs to just 8. It was a press release of English heritage which set me off in search of the weird local places that have changed British politics. It boasted that there had been a 20% surge in visitors to Barnard Castle in 2021, thanks to their recent celebrity ambassador Dominic Cummings and his lockdown-breaking shenanigans. That's a lot of people walking around making eye test jokes. Well, brilliant Times Radio listeners started sending in other ideas for obscure places which changed British politics. So many of the key turning points which have decided who runs the country and doesn't, and how they run it or don't, have taken place not in the mock Gothic crumbling courtyards of the Palace of Westminster or the higgledy-piggledy terraced houses of Downing Street, nor in the windowless halitosis hotspots of party conferences. Instead, they've played out in towns and cities and villages across the country. Unlikely, often humdrum places where accidents happen that change everything. So, I thought this tour should probably start back where it all began.
Barnard Castle is a sort of posh market town you get across the north of England, nestled on the banks of the River Tees. It's named after and built around the medieval castle ruin of Barnard Castle. The town centre has got all of the high street names you'd expect, with a good smattering of independent shops. And the town was minding its own business when Dominic Cummings brought his family here in April 2020. They'd normally welcome visitors, but you might remember that back then there was a pandemic on, and he really shouldn't have been here. It was here on the banks of the River Tees on April the 12th, 2020, that Dominic Cummings parked up for a little rest. He and his family had driven the 30 miles from his family home on the outskirts of Durham to Barnard Castle, the town. He insisted, of course, that he did not visit the castle, but he couldn't have done because it was shut because there was a pandemic on. But they parked up by the river, they discussed the situation, and then Dominic Cummings felt a bit sick. So he walked along the riverbank, sat here for 10, 15 minutes, and then went back to the car. All perfectly harmless, he might say, but when details of it emerged more than a month later, it had a devastating effect on trust in the government and in the pandemic response. The weird thing, of course, about Dominic Cummings and Barnard Castle is he was only here, as is so often the case with a political scandal. It's not the technicalities or the legalities that people remember. It's the colourful detail. So few remember that Dominic Cummings drove to his in-laws on the outskirts of Durham. But everyone remembers that having recovered from COVID, he decided to drive the 30 miles south to Barnard Castle to test his eyesight.
My wife was very worried, particularly given my eyesight had seemed to have been affected by the disease. She did not want to risk a nearly 300-mile drive with our child, given how ill I had been. We agreed that we should go for a short drive to see if I could drive safely. We drove for roughly half an hour and ended up on the outskirts of Barnard Castle town.
So from down at the river, it's about a five-minute walk up into the town, past the, well, perhaps Britain's most photographed opticians. It's the Barnard Castle branch of Specsavers. Slightly unfairly, actually, it's one of two opticians. Bayfields is also just across the road and down the way. But there is the grey exterior of the Barnard Castle branch of Specsavers, right on the high street. But now, I think I've had a very busy morning on the spot reporting for Times Radio. So I think having come to the site where Dominic Cummings was seen and changed the pandemic forever, next I think I'm going to nip into a cafe, and in honour of it being where Dominic Cummings was seen, I'm going to have a lovely bowl of spotted dick with custard.
So we leave Barnard Castle behind. As part of my research of places that changed politics, I've gone deep into the archives and deeper still into one particular swimming pool.
Oh, so I think this is the first time I've ever done an item on the radio from a swimming pool. But this is not just any swimming pool. This is the swimming pool at Clifton House, where John Profumo first met Christine Keeler. He was the Secretary of State for War. She was a 19-year-old, a friend of Stephen Ward, who was a masseuse to the stars and royalty. This was on a hot summer's evening in 1961 that John Profumo and Christine Keeler met at this very pool. Stephen Ward had invited Christine and his friends to stay in Spring Cottage on the Clifton Estate, which Lord Astor gave him use of. And Ward and Keeler had decided to come in and have a swim. It was about 10:30 when Lord Astor brought his friends there. He was having a big dinner party. Various big names there. Lord Mountbatten, the war hero. Prince Philip's uncle, of course. Various businessmen, socialites. And John Profumo and his film star wife. Some suggestion they came out to look at this statue, at the bronze statue just at the end of the pool, of a boy sitting on the back of a fish, riding on the back of a fish, well, about 3 foot high. Anyway, they all came out in their dinner suits and ball gowns to take a look at it. And the story goes, as John Profumo rounded the corner first, around the high walls around this pool, he caught a glimpse of Christine Keeler in a state of undress. Now, the stories vary somewhat. Was she skinny dipping? Had she lost her costume because she'd borrowed it and it was too big? Had Stephen Ward hidden it? But for whatever reason, she was rushing to get a towel, her wet feet leaving footprints on the terracotta red herringbone bricks around the pool, which is still here today. She dashes for a towel to cover her modesty.
And it's from there the affair began. But then questions start being asked. Rumours start swirling. Profumo sends a note. Beginning with Darling, tells her basically he can't see her for a long time and it's all off. Keela gets in trouble with the police, as does Stephen Ward. Rumours bubble up in the papers and in the House of Commons about a minister and a call girl. And so, exactly 60 years ago, on March the 22nd, 1963, John Profumo got up in the Commons and said this.
My wife and I first met Miss Keela at a house party in July 1961 at Clifden. Among a number of people there was Dr. Stephen Ward, whom we already knew slightly, and a Mr. Ivanov, who was an attaché at the Russian embassy. Between July and December 1961, I met Miss Keela on about half a dozen occasions at Dr. Ward's flat, when I called to see him and his friends. Miss Keela and I were on friendly terms. There was no impropriety whatsoever in my acquaintanceship with Miss Keela. I shall not hesitate to issue writs for libel and slander if scandalous allegations are made or repeated outside the house.
Well, within months it was proved that was a lie. That he had indeed had an affair with Christine Keela. Lord Denning's report into the whole affair in late 1963 was so salacious, it became a bestseller. There was no actual proof that Evgeny Ivanov, the Soviet spy, had gained anything from Christine Keela, apart from the obvious. Stephen Ward committed suicide. John Profumo was eventually forced to resign from the government. It was a real test case in politics and British society generally. In the 1960s, the swinging 60s had got underway, and the old guard, the old conservative guard, was struggling to keep up with what was going on. Previously, affairs between cabinet ministers and young models would have gone unreported. And it's just a reminder that sometimes events happen in the most unlikely of places, and yet in British politics, they end up making a very big splash.
This is Matt Jolly taking on a tour of some of the places which changed politics. Still to come, it gets boozy. The shop where number 10 staff filled a suitcase with booze, and the pub where David Cameron left his daughter and Ted Heath misplaced his majority.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Matt Shawley on a whistle-stop tour of Britain, diving into my new book, 50 Places That Change British Politics. Alcohol and politics have always mixed. Just ask Kwasi Kwarteng, who found out he was being sacked as Chancellor by Liz Truss when he was in the back of his ministerial car reading Twitter right next to Fuller's Brewery on the corner of the M4 and A4 in Chiswick.
My view about last year's events is that I think it was a very difficult time. I think there was a bit of panic. And I mean, clearly, Liz Truss thought by sacking me, she would prolong her political life. But she resigned 6 days later. So that didn't work for her. And I think, you know, she went from quite, you know, overconfidence, perhaps, to terror-stricken panic, looking back. And I was very upset to be dismissed. I think Rishi Sunak has done a good job in stabilising.
The booze keeps flowing, though, so it's off to the shops.
It was here on the 16th of April 2021 that after running out of booze at a Downing Street party, which breached lockdown rules, someone came here with one of these to fill it with booze. It became one of the most iconic features of the Partygate story, so I'm going to find out just how easy it is to fill a suitcase full of wine.
Ooh. Good thing is, sort of nicely out of the way, so there's no one who needs to see just how much wine you're buying. Maybe a nice Sauvignon. New Zealand. Oh, yeah, this is what we want. Look, we'll have a couple of those. And maybe a couple of those.
Right, yeah?
Yes. I am going to pay for it, don't worry. I'm not going to run off.
Okay.
I promise.
Okay.
I'm just putting it, I want to see how much I can fit in a suitcase. As if he's not seen someone doing this before. Oh, there's a pound off on that one. That looks posh. It's got some gold on the label. I don't really know what one. How many is that? 2, 4, 6 bottles of wine. I'll get another one in there. Let's have a red, just in case there's, you know, a show off who works in the number 10 press office. Oh, yeah. Oh, they're good. Look, got some money off on those. Oh, yeah, that fits. All right, good. Zip that up. I can make a run for it. Not really. I am going to pay for it. Well, that is quite heavy now. I hope they didn't just send one person up here to do this. Shall I pay you here or do it there? It turns out it's not very convenient at all, carrying wine in this fashion. Undo it again. There's two of each, I think, yeah. Like that. Oh, lovely. That's it. Thank you. I suspect our number 10 friends didn't spend £71 on wine. They might have gone something a bit cheaper. Well, I don't know. Maybe they were claiming it back on the taxpayer. Thank you very much. Zip it. Oh, no, I'm holding up the queue now. Oh, zip up the suitcase. And then let's get out. So that was in and out of Co-op in 5 minutes, but let's see how long it takes now to walk down to Downing Street while wheeling the suitcase of wine. All right, stop the watch. That is 8.5 minutes of walking fairly leisurely from the Co-op to Downing Street. Although I think actually whoever was in charge of the suitcase on the night before Prince Philip's funeral went round the back, so nobody on the gates could see them going in with it. I better go home and drink all this wine now.
Well, from an off-licence takeout to drinking in.
Sitting outside the Plough Inn on the slightly rustic, I'd say, pub beer garden tables. It looks like any other pub, really. It's, it's a red brick. The Plough Inn, it counts a big sign. Beer garden around the back. A string of quite big Union Jack flags strung across the back. You wouldn't necessarily know that this is the Prime Minister's local, but it's a short yomp across the countryside from here to Chequers, the Prime Minister's official residence. And this was the pub where David Cameron famously left his daughter Nancy. He once told me that that was perhaps his biggest mistake when he was Prime Minister.
The one that worried me the most, obviously, was leaving Nancy in the pub, because of that one moment. You do have a total fear about what has happened. But she was incredibly relaxed about it. She was behind the bar, you know, pulling the pints and helping out. And still to this day has the cartoon in her bedroom, which says, you know, it's her sitting on a bar stool with her head in her hand saying, oh my God, I don't know what's going to happen, I've left my father running the country. It's a very good cartoon.
But the significance of this place goes all the way back to 1974, early 1974. Conservative Prime Minister was up against it. There were strikes, there were soaring energy prices, there were rows over Europe, which obviously is impossible to imagine today. And Ted Heath decided to call a general election, asking the country who governs Britain.
But then by the halfway point of the campaign, some of the polling suggested the Tory lead was shrinking. One poll suggested that an 11-point lead was down to just 5.5 points after just 5 days. So, on Sunday, the 17th of February 1974, Keynes showed that everything was absolutely, totally fine. Ted Heath invited some of his top team to Chequers for a strategy meeting. And that morning, he came yomping over the countryside with Lord Carrington, his Conservative Party chairman and energy secretary, for a little pre-lunch drink here at the Plough Inn in Cadston. And on the way along this, it's very picturesque part of the world, they bumped in totally naturally to local people leaning on their front gate, hoping to chat to the Prime Minister. And it has to be said, it was supposed to be a break, a day off from campaigning. But luckily, somebody remembered to tell the television and newspaper cameraman to make sure the whole thing was recorded. In fact, just right here in the car park, a horse rider spent an hour sitting, waiting to catch a glimpse of the Prime Minister. And he drank half pints of bitter for the photographers. Then he came out here and took yet more questions, more sips of his beer.
We've got our problems ahead, and I've been saying this to the country. I've said it at every meeting, it's in our manifesto. But as a result of the change in the world situation, we're going to have difficult times.
The Times said he was wearing a heavy blue yachtsman's sweater, while the Telegraph went further, claiming he was wearing a couple of sweaters. And he was asked how it was all going. And Heath insisted that the first 10 days have gone extremely well. There won't be any changes of strategy because the issues are absolutely paramount. And the reason that this is somewhere that changed politics was having insisted he would not change strategy. Perhaps he should have done. The Tory campaign struggled afterwards. There was more bad economic news. Enoch Powell, a former Conservative cabinet minister, said he was standing down and suggested people vote Labour instead. And so, on the 28th of February, polling day in 1974, Labour won 14 seats, taking them to 301, just 17 short of a majority, but it meant that they were the biggest party, with Ted Heath's Conservatives down 28 to 297, which meant there was a hung parliament. Howard Wilson became Prime Minister for the second time, and Heath's gamble had failed, which means he might have been better off changing strategy rather than popping down here for half a bitter. Well, all this talk of drink means I think it's probably my turn to go to the bar. Cheers.
All of these places come together in planes, trains and toilet doors. So the planes, well, the most significant for me is polling day in 2010 when Nigel Farage was standing as a candidate in Buckingham and decided to go up in a small plane with a UKIP banner fluttering behind. But the banner got caught in the propeller, the plane crashed, and for a brief moment, Nigel Farage thought he was going to die. That he survived surely changed the course of political history. It's hard to argue that the EU referendum would have happened at all without Nigel Farage being around to push for it. So that's the plane. Lots of great political stories involve trains. Andrea Leadsom sitting down with Rachel Sylvester in a Costa at Milton Keynes train station, derailing her hopes of becoming Prime Minister.
I was explaining to that journalist, who shall not be named, by me anyway, what it was that I didn't want her to write. And therefore I was sort of assuming that she wouldn't write it because I'd asked her not to. But of course, since it was an on-the-record interview, you don't get to, having set the terms of the interview, you don't then get to change them halfway through. And that was the problem. That is totally on me. You know, it was ridiculous. And to not take anyone else along and to not even record it.
Perhaps the most dramatic train story played out in 1830, on a railway line not far from Warrington. But to get there, I had to go by car.
Well, let's just pull in over here. That sign says no parking in front of gate, 24-hour access required. Network well, but I think actually after last week, they haven't got any trains in the north, are they? So we should be all right here for 5 minutes. So let's get out and go and have a look. Now, I have read online that it's quite difficult to actually see the spot, despite the fact it's quite an historic moment for politics, as well as the fact there's a train there. It's a big moment for politics as well as for the railways. So actually walking over this railway bridge here,
quite high walls, can't see anything over. So let's just dash across here. So it was back in 1830, the very first passenger steam railway was being opened, going from Liverpool to Manchester. Oh, hang on, there's a big sort of trench. Jump over that. And it was the first time that a steam passenger railway was going to be open to the public. And so inevitably, you know, all politicians love a PR stunt, a hullabaloo, a grand opening, a ribbon to cut. So they invited all sorts of local dignitaries. Prime Minister, the Duke of Wellington, was there, cabinet ministers, and as you would expect, local MPs. And the train was going from Liverpool, which is what, out west where I am, up to Manchester. And on the train, amongst the VIPs, was a guy called William Huskisson. He was an MP in Liverpool. He had been in the Duke of Wellington's cabinet, but they'd fallen out and he'd ended up with... God, it's quite muddy, actually, where I am. This sort of field that I'm trudging through. And as the train set off from Liverpool with all the dignitaries on it, there were sort of six or seven other trains sort of shooting up and down the railway line to sort of show off the power, the might of this new steam railway, which is going to transform life in Britain. And not long after they'd set off, the train stopped right about where I am now. It was then called Parkside. It's just in the village of Newton-on-the-Willows. And William Huskisson, with some other passengers, got off. They were told not to, but he got off anyway. Then a cry went up that a third train was coming down. That was Stevenson's Rocket. And people who'd got off of the train, and William Huskisson had got off the train because he'd hoped to go and shake the hands of the Duke of Wellington to try and make peace with the Prime Minister in the hope of some sort of political comeback. Instead, in the melee, William Huskisson, who was an accident-prone man at the best of times, tried to get back on the train, dithered, panicked, then clung to the carriage door, which then swung out. He lost his balance and fell. And as he fell onto the tracks, as Stevenson's Rocket was approaching, he tried to wriggle to safety, but in doing so, actually managed to make things worse. He somehow bent his left leg, so it crossed the track twice, which meant that Stevenson's Rocket went over both his calf and his thigh. And a blood-curdling scream cut through the late morning air here in this beautiful bit of countryside. He was heard to shout, "This is my death," as he was taken away for medical treatment. And he wasn't wrong. It was several hours later that he was pronounced dead in Manchester at about 9 o'clock at night. But the train remained here, with the Prime Minister and his cabinet and train station bosses still on it. And an argument ensued about what should be done. The Prime Minister, the Duke of Wellington, wanted to cancel the whole thing, not head on to Manchester. The railway bosses were concerned this might not be the best advert for the railways. If the very first steam passenger railway to Manchester should be cancelled due to a fatality. In the end, the railway men won the day, and the train did continue on to Manchester. Now, what's really interesting about William Huskisson is no one would describe him as a great political giant. His imprint on political history is very light. But he served under five different prime ministers: Pitt, Godric, Wellington, Canning, and Liverpool. Now, what's interesting, there had been rumours he might have been on his way back, that the Duke of Wellington was considering bringing Huskisson and others back into the cabinet. So maybe there would have been another act to his political career had he not died on this railway line in front of me. Now, what's extraordinary is that perhaps his biggest legacy was the one he had on the railways. The publicity surrounding the accident here in Newton-on-the-Willows meant that many more people heard about this new, cheap, fast form of transport and were frankly undeterred by the small matter of an early fatality. 500,000 people travelled on the Liverpool and Manchester line in its first year. And passengers have been claiming about services ever since, while politicians, of course, get the blame for the delays and cancellations which beset that very first day of the railway. But I've walking a bit further along the line, there's a slight clearing, there's a gap in the hedge, so I can see through the railings. There is a sort of monument erected to William Huskisson, but what's so frustrating about it is that it's across the railway line. You can't get to it. But as I understand it, the plaque at the back is a sort of square
sort of monolith thing with a white archway almost and an inset panel, a tribute to William Huskisson. And the inscription on that monument reads, "A mark of personal respect and affection has been placed here to mark the spot where on the 15th of September 1830, at the opening of the railroad, the Right Honourable William Huskisson MP, singled out by an inscrutable providence from the midst of the distinguished multitude that surrounded him, in the full pride of his talents and perfection of his usefulness, met with the accident that occasioned his death, which deprived England of an illustrious statesman and Liverpool of its honoured representative, which changed a moment of noblest exaltation and triumph that science and genius had ever achieved into one of desolation and mourning, and striking terror into the hearts of assembled thousands, brought home to every bosom for the forgotten truth that, in the midst of life, we are in death." And just at that moment, a train goes by, which seems pretty fitting. But I better trudge back to the car, so our tour might continue.
And finally then, to the toilet door. And I should acknowledge that as soon as I started compiling this list of places that changed British politics, one location kept being suggested. Granita. The North London restaurant is where Tony Blair and Gordon Brown supposedly sealed the deal, which would see Gordon Brown stand aside so that Tony Blair could become Labour leader.
"It is time for you to go and let the future rest with those that have the courage to face it, and we have that courage in this party."
The problem was, everyone I spoke to said Granita was not all that. The deal had been done before. It doesn't even feature in Tony Blair's memoirs. For this, we have to go back to the days after the death of Labour leader John Smith in 1994. All the key discussions that happened during that time took place at the homes of Tony Blair's friends and family. You could see which way the wind was blowing. And on one particular night, Tony Blair was alone in the front room of the Edinburgh home of his old school friend, Nick Ryden. Nick Ryden had gone to the pub, leaving Blair and Brown with a bottle of whiskey and a takeaway menu. Tony Blair sat and waited, and waited, and waited. He jumped as the telephone began to ring. It not being his house, he let the answering machine take it. "Tony," a voice boomed from the box in the corner. "It's Gordon here." At this, Blair was a little freaked out. "I'm upstairs in the toilet, and I can't get out." Nick Ryder was a property developer. It was in the process of doing up this big house in a posh suburb of Edinburgh. A new door on the bathroom had not had its inside handle fitted. Gordon Brown's cries for help had gone unanswered. For more than 15 minutes, he'd been using his big brick of a mobile to call round friends and colleagues to get hold of Nick Ryden's landline number. Tony Blair didn't have a mobile and wouldn't get one till after he left Downing Street. When Blair finally climbed the stairs to rescue his colleague, he had an ultimatum, shouting through the door, "Withdraw from the contest or I'm leaving you in there." And thus, history was made. I once asked Tony Blair, more than 25 years after Nick Ryden's toilet and Granita and all of that, if he wished with hindsight that he tried to sort out the relationship with Gordon Brown properly before going into government.
"I don't think it was sortable in the end, because it was born of what was a very difficult passage when John Smith died and then I became leader. But certainly at that stage, whatever difficulties there were more than compensated by the enormous contribution that Gordon made. And, you know, the fact that he was there as a huge figure and carrier of a message, and with the capability also of impressing people completely independently of my position, you know, that was enormously important. But I think the essence of the problem was never really changed."
Perhaps in the end, he should have left him in the toilet. And that's just a selection of my 50 places that changed British politics. Planes, Trains and Toilet Doors is out now.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts.
Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.